Today is Wednesday, February 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
This was not a military operation. No military installations were targeted. The limited objective of the preemptive strike was to act decisively against the terrorist infrastructure of Jaish-e-Mohammed in order to preempt another terror attack in India. India does not wish to see further escalation of the situation.
That is a New Delhi Foreign Ministry reaction to Pakistan shooting down two Indian warplanes that had flown over its border in the divided territory of Kashmir today. Also ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un exchanged handshakes and pleasantries to kick off their second summit focused on denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. While Trump's former longtime personal lawyer Michael Cohen appears before a televised House oversight panel today, it's all on today's International Edition. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un exchanged handshakes and pleasantries to kick off their second summit. The two leaders greeted each other in front of a line of U.S. and North Korean flags in Hanoi. "It's an honor to be with Chairman Kim," Trump told reporters during brief remarks in front of reporters with Kim Jong-un before their scheduled one-on-one meeting. "I think the first summit was a great success, and hopefully this one will be equal or greater." Kim expressed confidence his second meeting with President Trump would be a success. "I am certain that an outcome will be achieved this time that will be welcomed by all people," the North Korean leader said. And for more insight into the summit, joining me from Hanoi is VOA Asia correspondent Steve Herman. Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
Yes, good. It's now morning.
Yes.
Morning here in Hanoi.
Yes, good morning to you. Well, what does President Trump need to do to convince leader Kim to stop making nuclear weapons?
Well, that may be unachievable in the eyes of many analysts. What we may see is some sort of continued commitment to a freeze on testing and bridging this difference over the definition of denuclearization. Of course, to the United States, that means removing, dismantling all the nuclear weapons that North Korea has. But in the eyes of the North Koreans, that's not going to happen until probably the United States agrees to remove its strategic forces on the Korean Peninsula, perhaps Japan and Guam. So some huge differences to be overcome. And it does not look like in the next day here that we're going to have any sort of superlative agreement along those lines. But what we do know is there is supposed to be a joint signing of something tomorrow, or today now, Thursday, here. One-on-one meeting between Trump and Kim will resume in the morning, then the signing of the joint declaration, and then President Trump is scheduled to hold a news conference in the afternoon.
Also, President Trump's focus has been on the economy of North Korea. So will this give him an edge, considering North Korea's economy is so poor?
Well, what he has been signaling to Kim Jong-un since they both arrived here is basically telling Kim, hey, look around at Vietnam, see what this communist country has achieved in terms of a capitalistic economy, and your country can do the same thing if only you denuclearize and establish diplomatic relations with the United States and have those sanctions lifted against you.
Well, Steve, President Trump praised Kim for his decision to start a dialogue. Do regional experts think that Trump should schedule routine summits with Kim?
Well, there's some speculation that we may be seeing summits between the two every year, presumably if Donald Trump stays in office past 2020. But it's quite clear that the president wants to see things progress on a track that could lead to what could be termed a success and a victory by both countries, as well as the tremendous skepticism that President Trump is facing in the United States, especially from national security Democrats who feel that this is really being approached in too much of an ad hoc manner, and they want to see something laid out strategically.
Well, thank you so much, Steve, for joining us. That's VOA Asia correspondent Steve Herman in Hanoi. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump's former longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen, told a congressional investigating panel today that Trump is a, quote, racist, a con man, and a cheat, unquote. Cohen, at the start of what is expected to be hours of testimony, told lawmakers that Trump knew what his campaign advisor, Roger Stone, was in contact with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange about the release of hacked Democratic National Committee emails damaging to his 2016 opponent, Hillary Clinton, before WikiLeaks released them to the public. Cohen said Trump never expected to win the presidency. Well, for a closer look at today's hearing, joining me in the studio is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thank you so much for joining
me. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Well, in hearing just a little of his testimony, and as I just mentioned, Michael Cohen called President Trump a racist, a cheat, a con man, even an adulterer. So what does he hope to accomplish with these comments?
Well, Michael Cohen says it's about telling the truth now. He is a convicted liar. This is something the Republicans on the committee were quick to highlight all through the hearing. They're not, though, really pressing him about some of the specifics of things that he's brought up. For example, the fact that he believes Trump was aware of efforts by Roger Stone to coordinate with WikiLeaks to release some of these damaging emails. The president has all along denied that. He also produced some extensive evidence, including, reimbursement checks in terms of related to the payment of porn star Stormy Daniels as hush money, who'd had an affair with the president. Again, the president denies those aspects as well. So this was about Trump painting a broad picture, which is what you alluded to at the beginning, which is rather disturbing and negative in some ways, but also specific incidents of where the president may have done something that previously he has said he did not do.
Well, also, Cohen was disbarred as an attorney for lying to Congress, as you mentioned. He's scheduled to begin his prison sentence in May. So is this testimony a part of the deal that he made with prosecutors?
Well, I think it's not so much that as a desire for him to go publicly and, sort of correct the record in his view. He went through his statement in some detail about him as a person, how he's sorry for having lied all these years. But, you know, there's some fodder there for the Republicans because he worked for Trump for 10 years. And they are asking him things like, if you didn't like this, why did you stay so long? And trying to go through the litany of allegations that he's made against the president. And again, we should point out the president and his spokespeople have previously denied a lot of these things. But I think the key thing about today is to see it illuminated on national television before a national audience. This harkens back to things like the Watergate scandal in the 1970s, where key witnesses would testify against the president.
Absolutely. It certainly does. So is there anything in particular that stands out to you?
I think the overarching portrait of Trump, both before he became president and as president, that Michael Cohen is offering. Certainly Republicans are going to try to puncture that by challenging his veracity. But it's not a good day that this is happening for the president, and especially while he's in Vietnam trying to negotiate some sort of a deal with the North Koreans. It really shows the split-screen nature of the Trump presidency, you know, in stark
yes.
relief.
Now, also, what about Trump's party? How are they responding so far to this testimony?
They're on the attack. It's very aggressive in the hearing. They are trying to get at Cohen's veracity, but they are not really pressing him about the specific allegations he's making, for example, on the Russia investigation. So that's an interesting tactic. Basically, they're going to try to present the front that Cohen is unreliable, does not have any veracity as a convicted liar, so therefore anything he says is suspect. That is going to be their strategy moving forward.
Now, this is going to go on, I guess, a couple of days on television, his testimony. So then what is the next step after this?
Well, of course, we'll have to see. This is all leading up to what we assume will be an upcoming report by Robert Mueller, the special counsel, wrapping up the Russia probe. And we can expect other committees to ask Cohen more details about what he may or may not know about the Russia probe. He did say, for example, today he had no direct evidence of collusion between the president and the Russians. I think that is also something the White House and Republicans will seize on. But we'll be hearing more from Cohen. Right now, Democrats want to highlight him, not just in this hearing, but in others to come.
Okay, thank you so much for the insight. That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Well, the president's emergency declaration that would move funds from the military to pay for his border wall is facing an onslaught of legal challenges from private citizens, advocacy organizations, and more than a dozen states. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a resolution to block President Trump's emergency declaration for border wall funding. The resolution will now go to the Senate for a vote, but as Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani tells us, it's not likely to get past a presidential veto.
Senate Democratic Chief Chuck Schumer says the president's undercut his own argument.
I didn't need to do this.
An emergency, by definition, is something you need to do. It's an emergency.
Which Democrats say it's not. Many Republicans say they back the president's authority to declare the emergency, but Lisa Murkowski is among a few GOP senators saying they'll vote for the resolution.
He is overstepping into the legislative prerogative.
Even if both chambers block the declaration, the president's sure to win in the end. GOP leaders are confident there would not be enough votes to override an almost certain presidential veto. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Well, the Taliban says negotiations with the United States continue today in Qatar for a second day amid hopes of making further progress toward ending the conflict in Afghanistan. Despite a daily outpouring of bitter criticism against U.S. trade sanctions, the Chinese leadership seems to be implementing trade reforms it has avoided for years. And the Philippine government's pick of the transitional leadership for a new Muslim autonomous region shows early signs of isolating armed rebel groups that hope to share power, threatening the region's long-term stability. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A bee species called the Megachile Pluto, or as it's also known, Wallace's giant bee, hasn't been seen by anyone in the science community since 1981. Some thought that the species may have gone extinct. A team of scientists say they found a female of the species in the Moluccas, a group of islands in Indonesia. Considered to be the world's largest bee, the Megachile Pluto has gigantic mandibles, a reported wingspan of more than 6 centimeters, and a body length that some say is about the size of a human thumb. The researchers say they found the giant bee living in a termite's tree nest about 2.5 meters off the ground. They say the female Wallace's bee lines her nest with tree resin she gathers with her huge jaws to protect it from invading termites. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Australian Cardinal George Pell is spending his first night in prison after his bail was canceled. Pell was convicted on child sexual abuse charges. The president of the Australian Bishops' Conference, Mark Coleridge, and the Vatican reacted to Pell's conviction in Melbourne, saying the news has shocked many in Australia and around the world. The news of his conviction follows a four-day summit at the Vatican that Pope Francis called to deal with the continuing sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
The latest news about clerical sexual abuse was described as painful by the Vatican on Tuesday morning. It was made public after an Australian court suppression order was finally lifted about the December verdict in the case of Cardinal George Pell. The 77-year-old cardinal was one of Pope Francis's closest aides and the Vatican's prefect of the Secretariat for the Economy, or treasurer, until Sunday, when his 5-year term expired. A Victoria County court found him guilty of molesting 2 choir boys in Melbourne's St. Patrick Cathedral in the 1990s. Pell has always proclaimed his innocence, and his lawyers have lodged an appeal to the verdict. The Vatican's acting spokesman, Alessandro Gisotti, reiterated the Holy See's utmost respect of the Australian judicial authorities.
Out of this respect, we await the outcome of the appeals process, recalling that Cardinal Pell maintains his innocence and has the right to defend himself until the last stage of appeal.
Pell is the most senior member of the Catholic Church worldwide to have been convicted of child sex offences by a criminal court. He was found guilty on 5 charges. Reacting to news of the verdict, the president of the Australian Bishops' Conference, Archbishop Mark Coleridge, said the bishops also respected the Australian legal system, which would continue to judge the cardinal, and expressed hope that justice would be served through this process.
In the meantime, we pray for all those who have been abused and for their loved ones, and we commit ourselves anew to doing everything possible to ensure that the church is a safe place for all, especially the young and the vulnerable.
Archbishop Coleridge, for his part, is also being investigated for his alleged handling of information on child sex abuse when he headed the Archdiocese of Canberra. Coleridge attended last week's unprecedented summit at the Vatican on child sexual abuse by the clergy. In a homily he delivered at Mass on Sunday, he urged more transparency and accountability from the Church, saying, "We will not go unpunished." Pope Francis has in the past praised Pell for his honesty and response to the child sex abuse crisis, but in December he decided to remove Pell from his council of advisers. It remains unclear whether Pell will be defrocked in the same way as Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, the former Archbishop of Washington. The Vatican spokesman also said that in order to ensure the course of justice and while awaiting the definitive assessment of the facts in Australia, Pope Francis had confirmed precautionary measures already taken against Pell. For the time being, he would be prohibited from exercising public ministry and from having any voluntary contact whatsoever with minors. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Well, the late Louis Armstrong, also known as Satchmo for the satchel-sized jaws he used to blow his legendary trumpet, is world famous as perhaps the greatest jazz pioneer ever. Armstrong also blazed a path as an African American who achieved global success among black and white audiences on his own joyful terms. For this Black History Month report, VOA's Adam Phillips tells us about Louis Armstrong, African American icon.
That's Louis Armstrong's 1936 recording of Shine, a word often used as a derogatory term for African Americans. Indeed, the lyrics seem to play to racist stereotypes.
Oh, chocolate drop, that's me, 'cause My hair is curly just because my teeth are pearly.
But to leave it at that would miss Armstrong's magic and his message, says Ricky Riccardi, director of research and collections at the Louis Armstrong House and Museum in Corona, New York.
On the face of it, you know, the deck is stacked against him. But when you listen to him, he makes it into this kind of ode to self-love. He takes the song, he owns it. There's nothing self-pitying about it at all. And then when he picks up the horn, you forget about everything else, and it becomes the singular expression of who Louis Armstrong is.
Armstrong broke through several significant race-based barriers in an America then marred by infamous laws that restricted civil rights for minorities. For example, Armstrong was the first African American to refuse to play in hotels that would not accept him as a guest. He was also the first African American to speak on the radio in New Orleans, his native city.
He was the first African American to host a nationally sponsored radio show in 1937. First African-American to get featured billing in a movie, Pennies from Heaven, 1936. So breaking down these barriers one after another, but also going through hell, absolute hell on the road.
One day in 1931, for example, Armstrong and his all-black band were traveling by bus through segregated Tennessee with his band manager and his manager's wife, who were white. When the police found out, they arrested everyone. After their release,
he goes on the radio and he goes, "I want to dedicate a number to the chief police." And he played, "I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you."
Boy, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be tickled to death when you leave this earth, you dog. And I took you for my friend. The way you bit me in the back was a sin. You ain't no good, you rascal, you.
And the whole band, they all froze because they all thought they were all going to get arrested. But that was Armstrong's way, getting that message across even through the smile.
But sometimes Armstrong's smile brought criticism from black entertainers who saw echoes of the self-mocking racial caricatures others sometimes used to please white audiences. Riccardi believes the smiles were genuine. He says Armstrong felt that jokes and humor should be part of his act.
He thought that to be a successful artist, you needed to be an entertainer. You couldn't just play the trumpet all night long. Not to say that he didn't blow his top.
Armstrong could be fierce. In 1957, after the U.S. Supreme Court banned racial segregation in the nation's schools, Armstrong sharply rebuked President Dwight Eisenhower for lacking the courage to immediately enforce it. That was a risky move at a time when it was taboo for entertainers to criticize the president. Through it all, Armstrong was a global star. His first visit to Africa in 1956 took him to the Gold Coast, now Ghana, where they declared a national holiday in his honor. Here's an excerpt from his performance before 100,000 fans, a record at the time. A few years later, an African tour took Armstrong to what was then the Belgian Congo in the midst of a civil war.
But they found out that Armstrong was coming, declared a truce. And both sides stopped fighting, came to Armstrong's concert, carried him in on the throne, carried him back out, and then after he left, the war resumed. So that's the power of Louis Armstrong, that he had the power to stop a war.
Ultimately, however, Armstrong seemed to believe in people, regardless of their race or nationality. Everybody loved him. Adam Phillips, VOA News, Corona, New York.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, and Steve Herman, our White House Bureau Chief. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.